best-selling author Anne Lamott on Hope in the Face of Hate. Many people discovered writer Anne Lamott when her book Operating Instructions was published in 1993. The book about her son's first year of life introduced readers to Lamott's signature wit and unvarnished honesty. Her novels and nonfiction books cover topics ranging from writing to faith and family, and many have been bestsellers. Her intimate voice has won her legions of diehard fans. I'm Cindy Hahn. Today I'll speak with Anne Lamott about her latest book, which just came out this month. It's called Almost Everything, Notes on Hope, and it includes essays on how we can truly help our friends and family, why we should learn to not hate others, and why dark chocolate is not actually a food. Anne Lamott is next on Main Calling, but first this news. From the Maine Public Radio studios, I'm Cindy Hahn, and this is Maine Calling. Author Anne Lamott is the type of writer who makes people feel like she's their best friend, doling out advice, sharing her innermost thoughts, even when they're harsh or shocking, and making you laugh and cry all along the way. She has shared this relationship with readers in 7 novels and 11 nonfiction books, including Operating Instructions, about life as a single mother during her son's first year, and Bird by Bird, about writing and life. She's also known for books about faith and grace. In addition to writing, Anne Lamott is a teacher, and she's been honored with a Guggenheim Fellowship. Joining me today from the KQED studios in San Francisco, best-selling author Anne Lamott. She'll talk with us about her new book, Almost Everything, Notes on Hope. And as always, we want to hear from you. Do you have a favorite book by Anne Lamott? What have you always wanted to ask her about? Our phone number is 1-800-399-3566. You can send a brief email to talk@mainepublic.org, tweet at Maine Calling, or post to the Maine Calling Facebook page. Thank you for joining us, Anne, and congratulations on your new book.
Thank you.
And I wanted to start on a cheerier note today, but unfortunately, as we all know, the events over the weekend, there was just terrible news out of Pittsburgh with the shootings at a synagogue, and before that, the news about all the pipe bombs that were mailed out. But this is something that you write about in your new book, The Climate of Hate That We Have in Our Country Today. And you also write about hope in the face of it all. So can you talk about that message in light of what's happening right now?
Well, it's been a rough few weeks, beginning with I saw Kavanaugh. But the strange thing about these days is that when I'm on the air with you, Cindy, I can go get back in my car and something else catastrophic or a decision could have been made that is just appalling or breaks your heart. So what can I say except that I always have hope because of what we've already come through. And I always have hope. Well, you know, Mr. Rogers' mother famously told him when he was a boy and there was a tragedy or catastrophe, look to the helpers. And that's where you'll find faith and hope. And I find faith and hope in the helpers and the marches. I've had a lot of hope since the Parkland school marches from Florida. And the young people have shown up in such a profound way. That wasn't true 2 years ago, 10 years ago. The young women and the girls who had secured abortion rights and women's rights were not showing up. I guess they felt that it had always been thus, but now when any of the marches I've gone to in the last 2 years, it's been about a third young women, and that's exhilarating, and girls, and it's also white boys, because they saw what was happening to their African-American friends being shot by policemen who then might be acquitted, and they came over. So the youth give me hope. The helpers give me hope. The color of the autumn trees give me hope. I have to remember to get outside more and to look up at the sky, at the branches, at the birds. And then I grieve with everyone else, but I also remember that it's excruciating and it's glorious all at the same time.
You know, you mentioned the young people, and even the vigil last night in Pittsburgh was led or organized by the high school students, which matches what you're saying. Your book also addresses a lot of other big topics, life and death and family, religion, writing, chocolate. What would you say is the theme that ties it together, and what do you hope that readers are going to get out of this book?
Well, the theme is kind of every single thing I know that I believe to be true. I first made a list for my grandson, who's 9 now, and my niece, who's 15 now, right before my 61st birthday. I'm 64 now. And I wrote down everything that I could think of that people forgot to mention to me when I was coming up in the 50s, which is that families are hard, and they can be a crucible. And yet this is the work we're here to do, to find our own voice, to find our own truth, to learn forgiveness, to learn self-forgiveness. And I said in the book, you might as well do this work at the family table, because then you can sit there in comfortable pants, but it can be miserable. And I, some of the things that are true, that I know to be true, is that everyone is screwed up and worried and a little neurotic and anxious on the inside. And I wanted my young people to know that it's fruitless to compare your insides to other people's outsides, because people's focus is always on the surface and burnishing the surface and getting their weight down. And these young girls, speaking of which, and these young women with their gorgeous, beautiful skin and their and wearing so much foundation that they could write messages with their fingernails to their friends. And I wanted to say, it's beauty. You're beautiful, beautiful. And if you think somebody else has got it more together, get to know them. Get to know them. This is all of it. An inside job. And I wrote a long chapter on hate and healing from the hate. And it's called Don't Let Them Get You to Hate Them, which was something Martin Luther King talked a lot about, based on something Booker T. Washington first expressed so powerfully. So it's, dark chocolate. I want people to know. I want my grandson to know that 85% cacao chocolate was never intended to be an edible. And if you can't get yourself to like it, it's really okay. And if you have some, it's very effective to use as a shim under wobbly tables or chairs. And I wanted them to know that everything, almost everything, will work again if you unplug it for several minutes, including themselves. So some of the things are about food and this hard path of learning how to feed ourselves and to live inside our bodies without shame. And there's a chapter on writing. My little one, I started teaching him his classes, kindergarten classes, writing workshops based on Bird by Bird, but I had to use a much, much simpler vocabulary. And I told him every single thing that's in Bird by Bird. I told him really short assignments, which is what Bird by Bird means. I told him to write really poopy first drafts, and they were really paying attention. But it turned out one of the kids had spread the rumor that I owned the local library. So, but then afterwards, as I recount in almost everything, my grandson came up to me, 5 years old. He said, "Nana, that was terrible." And I said, "What?" And he said, "You told us you teach us how to write a whole book, but you only taught us how to write one page." And I said, "That's all I can teach anybody, honey." So it's really every single thing that I think is true. And I think love and truth are our great hope.
Now, you're very quotable. And you mentioned one of the lines from the book that, of course, went and became a viral meme about unplugging. Can you say the line and talk about that a little more?
Well, I think I said it. I can look it up because I've been on book tour and I'm very spaced out. And here it is. It's on page 67. And in its entirety, it's called Unplugged. Almost everything will work again if you unplug it for a few minutes, including you. And that is the truest thing I know. I mean, especially, this is true of the younger people, but it's true of me and probably you and most of our colleagues, is that we're just always plugging, fixated on our telecommunications devices, you know, and wanting to be here for our lives and wanting to have a sense of immediacy and vitality and presence. And yet I'm constantly checking my phone for texts or Google alerts or whatever it happens to be. And so I want the kids to know that a lot of the time when they're just feeling so anxious and, you know, maybe having a hateful response or feeling doomed. You know, the original title of this book was Doomed, Notes on Hope. But anyway,
that
I wanted
got mixed,
them to know
but...
that, yeah, the publisher didn't love it. But I want them to know that if you just unplug, if you turn off everything for 5 minutes, when you come back, it's like you've been spritzed by a plant mister, you know, and you're back. You're kind of back in the saddle and back in life with a capital L. But it's hard to do, but I make myself do it all day.
So not even just literally unplugging and getting off the social media, but unplugging as in getting out into nature and all the other things you advocate.
Well, if you can, the best possible thing is to get outside. I've told this story before, but it's also in this book. My pastor taught us that you can trap bees on the bottom of mason jars without a lid on it because they don't look up. And so they'll just walk around bumping into the glass bitterly and mumbling when all they have to do is look up and they could take off. And so the first thing I knew was that I can't do anything with an on-off switch. It's like I'm like my mother's child, and it's like I have a missing app in my brain. And so I have 9-year-olds helping me constantly. But anything that stops working with an on-off switch, usually if you unplug it at the wall and wait a few minutes, it'll work again. 90% of stuff. I can hardly work a toaster. But and then with myself, with me and my mind, my monkey mind with, you know, catastrophic thinking and tremendous anxiety about the political climate, if I unplug, if I stop for five, if I can go outside and look up at the stars, you know, or the moon. You never go outside and think, well, that's a medium moon tonight, or or even if it's raining, you know, it's just so lovely to have a little bit of wetness on your face. It's again like a plant mystery. You don't go out and go, well, it's kind of a medium starry sky tonight. You go outside and you look up and you say, wow. I wrote a book of prayer called Help, Thanks, Wow. And that was, wow is the, like the praise prayer where you're, every time you see it, every time I came home last night from book tour and I saw the Golden Gate Bridge and I said out loud, wow. And I've been doing this for 60 years, you know.
That's great. And you also mentioned that hate is a whole chapter, or not hating is a chapter in the book. And one of the points that you made in there, sort of the theme of that section, is that a great reason, these are your words, a great reason to give up our hate is revenge, to deprive the haters of what they want. Is that relevant?
Yeah.
Again, in the context of what happened this weekend, is how do you apply
well,
that?
Well, hate is always relevant, and hate is healing the hate. For me, it has been an inside job because a year ago, I was consumed. I said also in the hate chapter that it fuses you with the people that you hate. It turns you into them. Mm-hmm. And you know, and I said in the book that it's like you're all parts of the characters in Night of the Living Dead. You know, you're the virus, you're the zombies, and you're the victim. And, you know, this is not how we want to live, to be all parts of hate, the host, the carrier, mm-hmm. and the next person who gets bitten. We want to live in freedom. Service gives us a huge respite from hate, to be of service to the poor, to be of service to the elderly, and anyone that needs somebody to sit with them and listen is how we begin to diffuse hate. We take the action and the insight follows that we've got the victimized self-righteousness inside of us. We cannot control much of anything, but we can begin to do the work of healing on ourselves, and then we have that to offer.
Okay, I think your fans would love to hear some of your words in your voice. So is there a passage that you could share with us and read to us a little bit from the new book?
I thought I would just read the first page and a half, if that's okay.
Great.
This is the prelude. I am stockpiling antibiotics for the apocalypse, even as I await the blossoming of paper whites on the windowsill in the kitchen. The news of late has captured the fever dream of modern life. Everything exploding, burning, being shot, or crashing to the ground all around us, while growing older has provided me with a measure of perspective and equilibrium and a lovely long-term romance. Towns and cities, ice fields, democracy, people, all disappear while we rejoice and thrive in the spring and the sweetness of old friendships. Families are tricky. Families are a crucible. There is so much going on that flattens us, that is huge, scary, or simply appalling. We're doomed, stunned, exhausted, and over-caffeinated. And yet outside my window, yellow roses bloom and little kids horse around, making a joyous racket. In general, it doesn't feel like the light is making a lot of progress. It feels like death by annoyance. At the same time, the truth is that we are beloved, even in our current condition, by someone. We have loved and been loved. We have also known the abyss of love lost to death or rejection, and that it somehow leads to new life. We have been redeemed and saved by love, even as a few times we have been nearly destroyed, and even worse, seen our children nearly destroyed. We are who we love. We are one, and at the same time, we are autonomous. Love has bridged the high rises of despair we were about to fall between. Love has been a penlight in the blackest, bleakest nights. Love has been a wild animal, a poultice, a dinghy, a coat. Love is why we have hope.
Oh, that's nice. And it's your voice through your words that your readers really love about you, that you just put it all out there. And I have a friend, Susan, who is super excited that you're on Maine Calling, and she says about you, she is always so real. And your writing is very personal, very frank. How do you do that? Was there a role model who made you think, I can go ahead and just write as I feel it?
There were really such beautiful, beautiful writers when I was coming up as a writer. And my father was a writer, and he really taught me the habit that you do it by prearrangement with yourself, that you do it as a debt of honor. You know, you don't wait for inspiration. Someone once asked me what inspires me, and I said, debt, mental illness, and the desire for revenge, which is really terrible. But it turned out when I was a child, I had this gift. I was a good storyteller. If something happened to us on the blacktop or to someone else, for some reason, I would be able to find a place to begin the story to people who hadn't been there, or even people who had been there and didn't know what to make of it all. And I always did that. And my dad got sick when I was 23, and with brain cancer and melanoma, and there were no books on families coming through. It was like a atomic bomb had fallen on us. But back then in the 70s, you didn't mention death. It was unseemly. You know, death didn't really come out of the closet till the AIDS epidemic. And so I always started telling my writing students after that, write what you would love to come upon. I would have loved to have come upon a book where a family that was really bright and regular old family mess and could be funny about it sometimes would have written a book for me about how they came through. And I've really done that with almost every book since. So being real, people were so relieved with hard laughter because so many families have and are experiencing the devastation of losing someone to cancer. But we do what we've always done. We stick together. We get each other water. You know, 80% of life is showing up. I've always said that laughter is carbonated holiness. And if you and the people around you can laugh from time to time or with the sick person, it just bathes you in holiness or at least comfort. So I just discovered how much I love real and I love truth. There's so little truth in the popular culture. And I'm not sure if that's exactly answered your question, but that has sort of been my path.
It does, and thank you. We're talking with Anne Lamott. We're going to take a quick break now. When we come back, your comments and questions. This is Maine Calling. We'll be right back.
You make Maine Calling possible, as does Houston & Company, celebrating 30 years of fine furniture making. Showroom and workshop in Kennebunkport and online at houstonandcompany.com.
Dating is hard, but using dating apps is pretty easy. You see a picture and swipe right for yes, left for no.
Oh, no, bad shoes, wrinkled shirt, not my type. It's very rapid fire, like swipe, swipe, swipe.
Now that swipe is in question, Bumble and Tinder are fighting a legal battle over who owns it. That story, plus the last week of campaigning before midterms. This afternoon on All Things Considered from NPR News.
All Things Considered from 4 to 6:30 each weekday evening here on Maine Public Radio.
On the next Fresh Air, Jonah Hill, co-star of Superbad, Moneyball, and The Wolf of Wall Street. He wrote and directed the new film Mid-90s about a group of skateboarders in the mid-90s. That's the period when Jonah Hill was skateboarding, but he was never great.
Because to be great at skateboarding, you have to be willing to slam on your face down 10 stairs on concrete over and over and over and
Join
over.
Us.
You can join us for Fresh Air this evening at 7 o'clock right here on Maine Public Radio.
Welcome back. This is Maine Calling. I'm Cindy Hahn. Today on the program, we're talking with best-selling author Anne Lamott. She joins us from San Francisco. Her new book just came out this month. The title is Almost Everything, Notes on Hope. We invite you to join the conversation. Call 1-800-399-3566. Send a brief email to talk@mainepublic.org. Tweet at Maine Calling. Or post to our Facebook page. And we'll read a tweet now from Kim. I've been a huge fan ever since Operating Instructions, the anti-George Bush baby book. Traveling Mercies is still my favorite, though Bird by Bird inspired me to write. My question, how do you make your message of hope and faith new in each book, especially for the next generation?
Well, that's a great question. Well, each time I start a book, so much has happened since the last one. And the last book I wrote was called, I forgot. Let's see, I have jet lag. I've been touring, but let's see. Hallelujah Anyway, which is a gospel song we sing that says, you know, everything's doomed. And Heidi Heitkamp may actually lose her seat and my feet are killing me. But hallelujah anyway, because we're here. We're together. We stick together. We have endless and beautiful, beautiful books to get lost in and found in, and it's so beautiful in the fall. So, and the book, I forgot what the book was before that, but each time there's been a couple years, and so much has happened. Some of it has flattened me, and some of it has helped lift, you know, helped life pull me back to my feet when I have felt scared or really discouraged. So, I think the answer, the short form, is that I really pay attention. And that was the famous Henry James line, that a writer is someone on whom nothing is lost. And then there's also a line in Almost Everything, in probably about three of my books, from a priest named Father Ed Dowling, who helped Bill Wilson get AA started, 85 or whatever it's been, years ago. And Father Ed said, sometimes I think that heaven is just a new pair of glasses. And so I'm really available for the new glasses. But I also know that the willingness to change for me always comes from the pain of not changing. And if I've made myself sufficiently crazy with these obsessive and toxic self-righteous thoughts, then I'm willing to look around for the new pair of glasses, or what we were talking about last segment, to get my but outside and to look around.
And do you know what there is left to write about for you? What's next for you?
I don't have a clue. You know, I'm touring and doing events for a couple more weeks, so I feel that I get a pass.
Do you still get excited or nervous when a new book comes out?
Oh, I get very, very worried. Yeah, I always feel that the well has run dry and I'm going to get beaten up by the critics, and that people are going to go, boy, is she beating a dead horse. But it just comes with the turf. You know, every single writer I know has just a raging damaged ego and terrible self-esteem. And so we're all in it together. And, you know, the whole system of us all works because we're not all nuts on the same day. And so I'll be feeling very anxious and have terrible self-esteem. And I'll talk to someone and they'll say, you know what, remember I was there 6 weeks ago. I thought it was the end of my rope, and it turned out to be so much fun. I had such a great time, and this worked out. You know, we have to keep reminding ourselves and turning to what has worked out before, both in terms of maintaining hope and then having a little bit of confidence that this book is really new and fresh and valuable. There's a very funny story in this book. I teach Sunday school, and I have an 8-year-old named Cooper in my classes sometimes. And I said to him, Coop, do you believe that goodness and or maybe even God are with you and around you and within you and beside you, and that you know, that you can turn to this when you really don't have a clue how to proceed? And he thought about it and sort of tugged his chin on his chin thoughtfully, and then he said, yeah, about 40%. And I think it's my favorite story in the book, because I think 40% is a miracle. I would say that the level of hate and judgment and self-righteousness has been reduced by about 40% in me this last year. And it took a lot of work, and it took a deep dive into my own, the mess of me, and the judgment or the lack of forgiveness or the inertia. And so that's kind of what I have to offer. But back to you saying, do I have any clue what I'm going to do next? There's a line I love that I always share with my writing students by the great novelist E.L. Doctorow, the great old lefty, and he says, writing is like driving at night with the headlights on. You can only go a few feet at a time, but you can make the whole journey that way. And I always tell my writing students, this is how writers write. I tell people whose parents have just been diagnosed with Alzheimer's, you can only see a little ways in front of you, but you can make the whole journey that way. This is how I tell people who are getting divorced or getting together with someone. So, yeah.
Okay.
I forgot the question.
That's okay. It's all good stuff.
Okay.
We're going to go ahead to the calls now from Maggie calling from York. Hi, Maggie. You're on Maine calling.
Hi. What a delight to for you to take my call. I love your allusion or your quotation from Mr. Rogers, because he's my barometer. And
yeah,
also, I'm around the same age as you are. I'm 63. But my question is, I love your writing, but I'm always curious about people I admire. What's your favorite book or books and or authors and authors? Because I have mine, and yet I read everything.
Yeah, I do too. I read absolutely everything I can get my mitts on. My favorite book of mine, I have to say, is Some Assembly Required, which I wrote about 5 years ago with input from my son. And instead of Operating Instructions, which was a journal of my son's first year 29 years ago, it was a journal of being a grandma and a dad from Sam's point of view. 9 years ago, Sam had a child at 19, and boy, did it turn out I was having tiny control issues, because I think I have such good ideas about how everybody should proceed in a way that would make them much happier and more serene, and coincidentally make me more serene about everything. My mind always goes blank when I think of books that I have really loved or been influenced by. I loved Thomas Merton when I was coming up, although I was raised by atheists. I'm sure, like you, I discovered chapter books by about five, and that meant Pippi Longstockings, and then Stuart Little, and probably the greatest book of all time, and then Little Women, and then Little Men, and I found salvation there in a family that was, you know, where people drank, and my mom was a black belt codependent from Liverpool, which requires its own 12-step program. And I found salvation, like you might find salvation in God or Buddha, and I still do. And so at home, I have the new Barbara Kingsolver, which I haven't started, but I always love her. When I was coming up, I loved Ann Beatty. I've always been completely addicted to the New Yorker's fiction. I loved, when I was 21, 2, something like that, Lori Colwyn's book, Happy All the Time. I've probably given 100 copies of that away. I just read Dope Sick by Beth Macy about the opioid epidemic, and it reads like a novel. It is stunning from the point of view of people, addicts and their parents, people who have lost children and spouses, and the investigation into big pharma and the doctors who helped create this catastrophe, this tragedy. So I loved that book. I loved R.O. Kuan's book that was called The Incendiaries. It's about a cult. It's brilliant. I loved something Hurley's book. Oh, I forgot her name. Sorry. It's called The Devoted, about a young woman in a very, very disciplined Buddhist, a Zendo in Boston, that I thought was just brilliant, about her relationship with the master there and her search for freedom and truth. Oh, such a sucker for truth. And she's a wonderful writer. So it's a kind of book where, from a writer, you feel really jealous that her imagery is so fantastic, and then very, very grateful that she's come up with it.
Okay, I hope everybody had their pens out and got those down. It's a good reading list to go by. And in fact, we did get a tweet from Bob who says, a few years ago, I was reading Anne Lamott and her love of The Only Dance There Is by Ram Dass. I found a copy at a local used bookstore that day. Classic awareness-raising text. Mind blown. Thank her for that. So you did.
Oh, I love it. You have
written about Ram Dass.
I write about him in almost every book because he's so brilliant. He's had a terrible stroke and a beautiful recovery, and he's in Maui. My partner and I got to see him in April at a retreat. But in almost everything, I used that, my most favorite line of his, which is that ultimately we're all just walking each other home, and I live by that.
And that's in your new book as well. That's really
meaningful.
We now have a call from Janice in Goose Rocks Beach. Hi, Janice. What was your question or comment for Anne Lamott?
Hi, thanks for taking my call. I just wanted to say that I wasn't really enthused about listening in, and I was just driving around anyway. I'm looking for surf. And after listening for a few minutes, it really touched home with me that we can't let this environment suck us into the hate. You know, I get carried away on social media, and I just get fed into it and everything. And I know in my mind that I shouldn't, you know, take the bait and react and everything. And just hearing her say that by doing that, we are becoming what we hate in the first place. And that's a really good lesson for me to hear today. And I really appreciate it. I want to thank her.
Thanks,
Janice. Thanks for tuning in. Yeah.
We have a tweet from Ophelia who says, I am a huge indebted fan. Anne, have you ever given wisdom that you have come to regret or have wanted to recant? If so, how do you deal with that as a contemporary wisdom leader and modern prophet?
Oh, my God. If only you could see what I'm like in real life. I'm really not any kind of prophet, but I don't think the wisdom, I don't think I would recant that. There are a number of lines that I've written over the years that I'm really sorry I wrote and put out into the common well because they were not helpful and they were stupid and they were just trying to be funny. And every so often I get to take them out of a reprint of a book. Sometimes you just, you know, social media is written in ink, as it said in that movie about Mark Zuckerberg, and I can't undo things I've said that are stupid, but I try to make amends for them. I try to be my better self and to just watch the stuff that comes out of my mouth sometimes. Thank you.
Well, we have another message that came in here that says, just wanted to say a heartfelt thank you to Anne Lamott. I'm a therapist and was dealing with depression myself due to everything going on in our country these days. My therapist recommended your book, and it really helped lift my mood. Thank you for this book and all of your others. Thank you for giving me hope.
Oh, you're so welcome.
So,
you know, it gives a person hope to give hope to someone else. Like if you visit your crankiest aunt in elder care, who's been mean to you for years, and you bring her flowers. Flowers are hope. You bring someone flowers. Beauty is hope. You bring someone flowers, you bring them hope, and then hope exists again in the room you're in. So we think we're so hungry for what we're not getting all the time, what we think we need. What we're really hungry is what we're not offering, which is hope and attention and listening and a little bit of peace here and there. That's great. My experience anyway.
Messages of hope from Anne Lamott. We're going to take another quick break. But first, a word about tomorrow's show. We'll be talking about the flu and what you should know as we enter flu season. Email your comments and questions to talk@mainepublic.org. Tweet us or post to our Facebook page. You can also leave a voicemail before the show at 207-370-3487. You're listening to Maine Calling. We'll be right back.
You make Maine Calling possible, as do Otelco, formerly OTT Communications. From phones to fiber, serving Maine businesses for more than a century. Otelco.com. St. Mary's Health System Orthopedics, helping patients live their best lives in motion. Online at findabonedoctorme.org. And Husson's Gracie Theater, with pianist-lecturer Michael Hawley. Works by Chopin, Bach, and Bernstein, November 2nd. GracieTheater.com.
The Democratic Party is at a crossroads.
Your point of view has destroyed the party.
Let's not forget Stacey Abrams, who could make history.
Progressives want to swing left, but some moderates worry that could leave Democrats in the wilderness.
Whatever you think of these ideas, they don't win elections.
I'm John Donvan. On the next Intelligence Squared U.S. debate, will progressive populism save the Democratic Party?
That's coming up just a few minutes at 2 o'clock right here on Maine Public Radio. Election Day is fast approaching, and all this week, Maine Public Radio and television are broadcasting gubernatorial, Senate, and congressional debates. We expect them to be on demand at mainepublic.org/yourvote by the end of the day Wednesday. In addition, each of our debates will have multiple broadcasts on both Maine Public Radio and television. You'll find the radio and television debate broadcast schedule at the Your Vote site as well. You'll also find analysis of the important issues, in-depth interviews and profiles of the candidates, our Maine Calling candidate interviews, and more. All of this and more at mainepublic.org/yourvote, or click on the Your Vote banner on the mainepublic.org homepage.
Welcome back. I'm Cindy Hahn, and you're listening to Maine Calling. Today on the program, writer and teacher Anne Lamott. Join our conversation. Give us a call. Our number is 1-800-399-3566. And Anne, I heard that you had some happy news and got engaged a couple of months ago. Congratulations. Do you want to say anything about that or about your fiancé?
Well, my son, Sam, has our family motto tattooed on his forearm, and it says, "Never give up." And a few years ago, I was doing a benefit in San Francisco at a huge church where I was being interviewed. And at the very end, the woman who was interviewing said, "You've had so much blessing. You've had so much happen for you as a writer. You love your child. You have a beautiful grandchild you get to live with. Is there any dream for you that you still hold on to?" And I said, after a minute, I said, "Well, I'd really love to get married, or to be married," I said. And then some time passed. It was so weird, you know, so strange to blurt that out in front of 1,000 people, because if it didn't happen for me, then people would think,
feel sorry for a loser.
Yeah, feel sorry for me. And then a couple years ago, I went on this site that's Match, but for older people. It's called Our Time. And there was this gorgeous, very tall, educated, very spiritual guy who lived about 20 minutes away, but he was allergic to cats. Oh. But I wrote to him anyway. Yeah, and I said, and I love my cat, I loved my cat more than anything. And so I let it go. He wrote to me, and I said, "Well, I really love your profile, but you're allergic to cats, and that wouldn't work because I'd have to be at your house all the time, and my grandchild lives here half the time, blah, blah, blah." And he said, "Well, if you put brewer's yeast in a cat's kibble, I become non-reactive." And I thought, well, I bet he has a manuscript he wants me to read, since that was mostly the people that responded to my Match profile. Mm-hmm. And then about 3 months later, I saw this handsome, tall, maybe overly educated, very spiritual guy on our time. And I wrote again because I'm spaced out and I'm running a household and I had a book due and blah, blah, blah. And I wrote and said, I really like your profile. And he wrote back, you already rejected me. I think it's because I'm not Jesus-y enough. And I said, I don't care. It was the cat. And so we met for coffee a week or so later, and I've seen him every single day since. And then in about a month and a half ago, we were sitting on the couch watching the U.S. Open, and he said, can I ask you something? And I said, oh, sure. We're putting in a carport, and I thought he wanted to talk about the gravel for the carport. And I said, oh, sure. And he said, will you marry me?
Yeah.
And I said, what? And he said, will you marry me? And then he said, it'll be okay if you don't, because I love our life, and we can just have this life we have. And then I said, no, I'll marry you. And then I said, can I have a cat? Our cat had run away in the meantime. So anyway, so yeah, we're getting married in the spring, so never give up.
And a cat?
And a cat.
Oh, so
I haven't gotten the cat yet, though.
Okay, yeah, our best cat, of both worlds.
Yeah.
Terrific.
Two mints in one.
Well, congratulations.
Thank you. We will
go to Claire now, who's calling from Bath. Hi, Claire. You're on Maine Calling.
Hi. It's good to talk to you. I'm a huge fan. I'm a child of recovering alcoholics and have found great comfort in your books. And I texted my mom last night and I said, I think I'm having a higher power moment because tomorrow, you're going to be on this show and I'm from Pittsburgh and my family's in Pittsburgh. So I said to my mom, I said, what do you want me to ask her? And my mother is very political and passionate she really wanted to understand how she's going to get through this struggle she's feeling of the anger and the pain of our politics, of our time. And, I think about the prayers you always offer up of help me, help me, help me, and thank you, thank you, thank you. And is there another prayer that she can have to help her? Because she's feeling pretty wounded.
Oh, of course she is. And it's terrifying. And there's no way to not make it exactly what it was, which was a horrifying extremist attack on the entire Jewish community. And, it is like a anvil, like a bomb fell on Pittsburgh. And but the third prayer I was talking about earlier is, wow. And the prayer is Mr. Rogers' mother saying, look to the helpers. And the prayer is not hating as a response to something that somebody who hates you has done. And the prayer is always love. And the prayer is always make me a channel of your peace. And the prayer always involves breathing. And the prayer always involves being of service to both to the helpers and to the community at large. And, always, this is no longer a country that is safe for the very old or the very young. I think that began with Reagan. And when so much tax money was taken away from the support of people that might be really sick or babies or addicted babies or shut-ins. And so we give what we can. A prayer is, what do I do? Could you get back to me? Could you get back to me? If you follow Twitter or Facebook, you'll see links to sites that are very much a part of the healing, both the spiritual healing and the economic healing that has been ongoing for the last couple of years of resources being taken away from just the most precious and vulnerable people. So you give $10, you give $100, you have a flea market on Saturday, and you give $37 of the proceeds to an organization that works for peace. You give money to this synagogue was attacked because of its passion to help refugees. So you give money to the refugees and you give money to rebuild or to help the healing of the synagogue. You just look for, you put on the better pair of glasses and you see where you can plug in to help, to love, to keep the faith, to show up, and you cry a lot. You know, and I think crying is its own kind of prayer, and the culture tells you to stop crying way before you're ready to. You know, if you have lost someone that you can't live without, you're expected to get over it in a few months. And I don't think you're supposed to get over or are going to be able to get over certain losses. And so I always tell people, now is the time for crying. Now is the time for tears. Now is the tears will cleanse you and hydrate you and wash you, and they'll water the new seeds that are in the ground at your feet that you can't possibly know what they are and what they will offer. So, you know, we're in the dark, but you can see a few feet in front of you. So you do the next right thing, as the Buddhists would say, and then you rest, you cry, you stick together, you bring the suffering food. We do what we always have done. We vote.
Thanks for the call, Claire. And Anne, you mentioned that there's another passage in your book that probably picks up on some of the advice you just gave Claire. Did you have that there and want to share that with us?
Yeah. I've read you the very beginning of the book on hope, and I think I'm going to read a lot of this book as I'm looking through it for what I wanted to read. Was written in the aftermath of the terrible fires in the wine country, Santa Rosa.
Oh.
The devastation, the death and the absolute destruction. It looked like nuclear bombs had fallen. I was up there a lot, and it looked like bombs had fallen, and then the renewal was breathtaking. I wrote about, my son has a website called How to Human, and he wrote his own description of this story on it. But he flew into San Francisco at 3, and he was in Santa Rosa at 6 with cases of water and 20 sports bras for women, because he'd called the people that were organizing the relief efforts, and they said, we have tons and tons and tons of used clothes, but the used bras are just too depressing. We want sports bras in all sizes. So he writes about this on How to Human, but he said, how am I going to explain this to my accountant? But he did. And so let me find what I wanted to read. I'll just read you the last paragraph of the book.
Mm-hmm.
The artists give me hope, and the scientists, painters of light, and physicists. As soon as regular people like me can grasp that light is particles, like specks of sand, and at the same time that light is waves, like the ripple in water, then scientists step in and prove not only that light is both, but that when we observe light, we change it. I mean, come on now. It gives me hope that all truth is paradox, because it means no matter how awful things are, there's also beauty about to be exhibited, about to be born. Life is way wilder than I am comfortable with, way farther out, as we used to say, more magnificent, more deserving of awe, and I would add, more benevolent, more well-meaning and kindly. Waves and particles, redwoods, poetry, this world of wonders and suffering, great crowds of helpers and humanitarians. Here we are alive right now, together. I worry myself sick about the melting ice caps, the escalating arms race, and the polluted air, even as I look forward with hope to the cleansing rains, the coming spring, the warmth of summer, the student marches. John Lennon said, everything will be okay in the end. If it's not okay, it's not the end. And as this has always been true before, we can hope it will be again. We have all we need to come through. Against all odds, no matter what we've lost, no matter what messes we've made over time, no matter how dark the night, we offer and are offered kindness, soul, light, and food, which create breath and spaciousness, which create hope sufficient unto this day.
And that's how the book ends.
Mm-hmm.
That's wonderful.
Thank you. We have a
question from Mary on Facebook. She would like to know how you stay optimistic in the face of climate change.
Well, I wrote there's a big piece on hope. It's almost like a condensation of this book in the October National Geographic, of all places, which I grew up on, but which I'm, because I'm not scientifically oriented, I have not written for. But so it's a lot about where that my hope lies with science. My hope so lies with the young scientists. And I donate money. Miracles and reversals take money sometimes. And so I send money to the concerned scientists. I send money to everybody who is doing profound and radical work in the green in the movement towards ecological healing and restoration. And of course, I urge people to vote for people who believe in climate change. That's where it all begins, is to get people in power who believe the scientists. And I send money to people who are suffering as a result of climate change. I send money to Oxfam, Doctors Without Borders, ACLU, who represents the climate, the environment. I wrote about this a lot in the National Geographic, but I put the good pair of glasses on. You can't go a block, even in my tiny little town, without seeing recycling buckets. You know, we are recycling now. And whenever there's a catastrophe that is ecology related, and certainly those terrible, terrible fires in the wine country were, in the level of the hurricane destruction, are all completely related to climate change. Then we send money to the rescuers and the helpers, and we do what we can. We, you know what we do in the face of it all? We just can't bog down in the hugeness of the problem and the catastrophe. We do what's possible. We do what's possible, and we do it today.
We have one, I'll do this real quick, from Solange on Facebook. She heard that you were coming and says, "Be still, my heart." Will she ever come to Maine? Have you been to Maine?
I've never been to Maine. And that's the reason is, it's so far away. Even for me to get to Boston is a 6-hour flight. I'm older now. My body is much less forgiving. And I feel Boston for days afterwards. And Maine is just so far away. And I have dear, dear friends in Maine. And I hope I get to meet you all someday.
Well, it's an open invitation for you to come here. So thank you, Annie, for joining us
today. You are so welcome, Cindy. Thank you.
Anne Lamott is a best-selling author. Her latest book is titled Almost Everything, Notes on Hope. Nikki Shields ran the board today. You can find past editions of Maine Calling, as well as helpful links and resources, by visiting mainecalling.org. Today's show will be broadcast again tonight at 9. Tomorrow on the program, what to do about the flu. And a reminder, as we approach Election Day, all the Maine Calling Your Vote candidate interviews can be found at mainepublic.org. I'm Cindy Hahn, and you've been listening to Maine Calling on Maine Public Radio.